Hello and welcome back to the Isle of Wight show with me, Joe Redstone. Today I'm talking to Den Clare, who may well be familiar to some of you as a hypnotherapist working here on the island. I really enjoyed this conversation with Den because it was an opportunity to dig right into the details of what hypnotherapy is, how it is that it works, how does it affect the brain, and also the sorts of things it can help with. We don't just talk about hypnotherapy, we also talk about how it's related to NLP and psychotherapy, as well as a bit of background from Den about where he came from, how he ended up on the island, and what he thinks of the island at the moment. So here we go. Here is my conversation with Den Clare. I hope you guys enjoy it. Thanks. Hi everyone, welcome back. And I'm here today with Den Clare, who I'm sure is familiar to a lot of people out there. You would have seen his name around at various points and stuff. So first of all, thank you very much for agreeing to have a chat with me today, Den. Really appreciate that.
Very welcome. Sure it'd be a pleasure.
And we'll start off, if it's okay with you, with just a little bit of background about how you ended up on the island. Are you a local? Were you born here? Or, you know, what brought you to the island?
Basically, I was born in Aldershot in Hampshire. Went to grammar school, and when I left school, didn't really know what to do. There were a lot of options then. I was good at maths. I enjoyed figure work. So I thought, well, perhaps the bank. So of all the choices that I made, I actually went into Lloyds Bank from school. I was in the bank for about 18 months or so. I did number one cashier. I ran a little sub-branch in Frimley Green on my own with a little old guard that used to come out and look at 70-year-old old man, come out and look after me. So I ran the sub-branch, did about 18 months. And then after 18 months or so, I was called into the manager's office for my 6-monthly report. And basically, he said to me, "You've got a wonderful career in the bank, Mr. Clare. When you're 40, you will be a bank manager. Your life's there." I got home that day and I thought, whoever gets to be 40? I mean, that then, I was, what, 17, 18? Ancient. So I thought, no, I can't be doing this with a suit and a collar and tie and doing this stuff till I'm 40. No way. So the very next day, I went into the police station, which was next door, and said, I think I'd like to join the police. So the sergeant in there said, "Okay, what are you doing now?" And I said, "Well, I work in Lloyds Bank next door." He said, "Wonderful." He said, "As long as you're fit and healthy and well and passed a few little psychological tests and stuff, I'm sure we'd love to have you." So he gave me an application form, which I filled in the next day and applied to join the police. My parents were not very happy because being in the bank then was really a job to be respected and all the rest of it. But anyway, I went ahead, I joined the police. I did 3 months training in Sandgate, which I loved. It was all keep fit stuff and mock accidents, and you had to learn quite a lot of basic law definitions and different things as well. But I had a wonderful time for 3 months. You come out and you're posted, and I was posted to the Isle of Wight because they try as much as they can to get you posted a little bit away from home in case you're with the lads that you've grown up with and stuff like that. So I came to Shankton on the island, went into digs here, and when I came, I think it was sort of July, August, it was peak season. It was a good time. I was single. I was in uniform. Had a great time because lots of young ladies used to come up to me and say, "Oh, will you arrest me?" And I said, "Well, I'll finish at 6 o'clock. We'll talk about it then." So I had a good time as a single guy and thoroughly enjoyed the first 3 or 4 months. And then policing was walking around town, getting to know all the shopkeepers, the taxi drivers, local people. So it was quite sort of low-key, quite easy then. When the winter came, there was just nothing happening at all. And I used to go out when I was on nights at 10 o'clock at night and walk around and until 2 in the morning. And I remember walking often down China Avenue and the old trees are creaking. And I'm thinking, what am I doing here? So the winter was very long. I thought I'd start studying for my sergeant's exams. And then I thought, well, I don't really think this is for me. A lot of the attitude was not really what I'd hoped it would be. I was there really to help the public and help little old ladies over the road and all that stuff. And a lot of my colleagues were, you know, if somebody parked on a double yellow line or whatever, they'd rush over and try to book them, whereas I'd say, well, look, I'm back in 5 minutes. If you're here, I've got to book you, sorry. It was a different way, but I didn't like, there was a lot of aggression as well towards the young kids. So I did about a year, I think. And in the meantime, because I had quite a lot of time, when you're on nights, you come off at six, you sleep for a few hours, and then you've got daytime. So you've got quite a lot of spare time. And I met the people that ran Ramsden's Library, which was a library come a bit of retail shop in Regent Street. And I was talking to them and they said, well, would I consider, because after a while I was doing some bookkeeping for them and doing their stock taking in my spare time. And they said, would you consider working for us? Okay. So I thought about it and thought, well, no light, no nights, and as long as they pay me the same money, £12, £10 a week, whatever it was. So I went for it. I thought, well, yeah, I always listened to my little voice, and my little voice is like, can't go wrong, you know, go for it. So I went to work for them. And I said, as long as there is an opportunity of managing or doing something a little later rather than just serving in the shop. So I was there for a couple of years, and it came to the point, I didn't realise they'd only rented the premises. So basically I said to them, why don't you go to the bank and borrow money and buy the freehold? Oh, they were old school, very old school. No, you can't borrow money. You can't, particularly for property, it's not a sensible thing to do. And I said, well, would you mind if I went to the bank? I didn't have anything. I had a bike, had an old banger of a car, didn't have any security or anything. Went to the bank, but I knew just how to present a business plan to the bank, having worked in a bank. And amazingly enough, the bank said, yeah, we'll lend you the money. We hope you're successful. And I took over the freehold. And I ran that for with the other two, and then one retired, then the other retired. So I bought them out over the years, and then finished up some 10 years later, borrowed again to open another shop opposite. Right. And ran one as a toy shop, and it was Den's Toy Box, and the other was Den's Gift Box. For about, I don't know, 30, 40 years, I suppose. And no, then
I remember as a youngster wandering around the toy shop and looking at all the lovely things.
So many people say to me now, oh, remember Den's Toy Box? And so after many years, not retirement as such, but I wanted to do different things. Yeah. And so I sold first one freehold property and then the other. Okay. Paid off my mortgage. Actually had some money for the first time in my life. Borrowing money then was so expensive. At any one time, I probably owed the bank about 100 grand, paying 19% or something ridiculous. So every year it was make or break. I never knew whether I'd get there or not. But at the end, obviously, and I could see the writing on the wall, particularly for retail, going back now, 10 or 12 years.
Changed dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, Toys R Us opened up and thought, oh, well, there you are. You know, they can sell cheaper than I could buy. I mean, it was just getting silly. So, so I thought, well,
excellent. So, I mean, that's obviously the thing that's kind of one side of the coin. I'm sure there's more than two sides. But in terms of, you know, my perception of you, you're one of those characters who's sort of been, you know, growing up in Sandown, you've been, you know, sort of on the periphery for most of my life, actually. Mm. And the other big side of that is obviously what you do with your hypnotherapy.
Yeah.
So when did the little voice start talking to you about hypnotherapy?
Well, when I was about 14 or so, I had a problem with my eye. I had a cyst on my left eye. And I went to the doctor, and obviously it was a minor op. I mean, it wasn't a terribly big thing. My mother was a spiritualist. And she said, well, I want to take you to a spiritual healer in Aldershot. And I said, well, I'm not too sure about this, but obviously go along. So I went to this lady in Aldershot, and there were queues and queues of people outside her home, and they're all talking about, oh, she's cured somebody of this, cured somebody of that. And amazing. Everything was so positive that people were just, I was just listening to. So I went into this house, and there was this rather stout woman with just a bed, and she said, oh, lay on the bed. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's really strange. It was so totally different to me. And then suddenly she developed this deep Indian voice, "Hello, my son, I am Bullseye, aunt." And I think, "Oh, God, get me out of here." And she was in trance. And all she did really was just put a hand onto my eye three or four times. I've been there for about 2 minutes. And off I went. And I said to my mother, "Woman's crazy. You know, she's just suddenly become a man. What's going on here?" Mum said, "You've got to go back." She said, "Come back one more time." I went back one more time and exactly the same thing. And within a week, the sister had actually gone. So I thought, there is something here that I really need to try and understand. And so then I started studying. I went to work with Harry Edwards, who was a very famous spiritual healer in Shear in Guildford. I did training with him as a spiritual healer.
And roughly, where does this fit into your timeline? Are you still quite young?
That was very young. It was before I joined the police.
Oh, okay. So teenagers.
Yeah, teenage time. And the more I studied, the more I watched what was going on, I thought, well, so much of this is the power of their own imagination, their own mind. Mm-hmm. So much, I could begin to see that so much dis-ease, yeah, is dis-ease of the mind. Probably 60-70% of illness is psychological. Not saying it's not real, but if somebody is tired or frustrated or angry, this all turns in on the body. And so I studied a lot further then. I could see that hypnotherapy really was hand in hand almost with healing. And some time on, I had the shops by then. I went off to America. I did all of Gil Boyne's weekly sessions of hypnosis, hypnotherapy and advanced stuff in America. I studied quite a lot with a guy in Harrogate, Wilf Proudfoot, who was one of the leading ones in this country, and then a couple of other London companies. So I just, over the years, studied hypnotherapy. And then one day I got the courage. I thought, well, let's go for it. So I just set up the hypnotherapy consultancy.
Excellent. And can I just sort of jumping in there? Do you remember your first client?
My first one... My first one, I'll never forget. I'm not sure who was more nervous, this lady or I. She came to stop smoking, and I thought, do I really know what I'm doing? I did the session, and it seemed quite good, and it was a two-session job. And on the second one, she came back, and I did hear afterwards that she actually stopped smoking. So the first one worked.
Excellent. You should have stopped there. 100% success.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. So ever since then, I've continued studying. You've got this CPD now, continual professional development, where you've got to do so much a year studying some direction or other. And I find it totally fascinating because there is always something new. Every person that comes in is an individual, is totally different, showing different symptoms, different things that they want to actually deal with. And it's totally fascinating.
Yeah, so fascinating. I'm a really big believer in sort of ongoing and continual learning. Mm. And obviously you've just referenced that with your hypnotherapy. Mm. So what is it that you continue to learn? Is it new techniques, or is it new ideas about how to talk to... Sorry, forgive me if I'm using the wrong word. Do you talk to clients or patients? What do we...
Clients, yeah.
And is it about how you talk to clients? Is it about new sorts of problems that are
coming
through?
It's the whole thing, really, because firstly, I call them clients. It's not medical. I make it very clear. There's disclaimers on my hypnotherapy booklet on my website that you must, if anything is at all in any way a medical problem, you've got to see your doctor first, and then either get a referral or come back and say you're cleared. Blah, blah, blah.
And so you can get a referral from
I get quite a lot of referrals now. It took me, well, the first 10 or 15 years was a bit doubtful with hypnosis, but now I do get a lot of them send people here, which is, you know, it's good. It's moved on now. The only problem there is that, unfortunately, it's not financed by National Health. Right. So I still work privately, which is a great shame. I'd so much prefer it if people could actually come here and have their fees paid and not have to worry. Sometimes I won't charge, but it's a barrier in a way. It's a shame that people have to. And I would never stop anybody coming here because they couldn't afford it. Right. But obviously, it's a private thing I do, so... So, yeah, clients, and I do make it, as I say, clear.
Yeah,
medical problems must be clear.
Sorry, just looping back around. And, and so the learning kind of covers all the different aspects.
The internet now used properly is amazing. I mean, there is so much wonderful information. So anything that comes up that I haven't dealt with, I go on the internet, I research to see all the possible aspects of it. I look at all the different treatments that are available, and then I tie that in with, I belong to two or three major hypnotherapy groups. And find out what research has been done, so that when the person comes along, I've got a much better idea of how to tackle what to do. And there is often things that I've never even heard of, obviously, unusual things. Latest research in hypnotherapy, it's all there. America sort of leads with that. Occasionally a new book will come out, textbooks, whatever, which I like to keep up with. So there's always something new.
Okay, and I guess the big question that I'd like to ask is, you know, what is hypnotherapy? So in my head, like growing up as a kid, you know, we've all seen these, you know, films and cartoons where, you know, the sort of bespectacled professor kind of, you know, waves a watch in front of someone's eyes and they go into this kind of trance thing and then, you know, they,
that's something the old else concept happens. That we're trying to sort of get away from.
I'm sure. So, so what is hypnotherapy? How does it
work? Right, basically, your mind's in two parts. You've got a conscious thinking mind. That's the top part of your mind that does all the thinking, decision-making, all the everyday stuff as you go along. Beneath that, there's a vast area of mind called the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is basically a computer. It stores information. It's not a thinking process. Everything that happens to you from birth is stored away there in your subconscious mind. And so what basically we do is, obviously, first of all, the first part of any consultancy is to get into what the problem is, how long have it's been established, we can look at, if possible, the cause. But all that information, whatever it is that's bad information or wrong information, is back in that subconscious mind, okay? When we're brought up as kids, as children, we're giving a lot of information from parents, from society, which is really totally wrong. And so we get a lot of negativity. If we're lucky enough to come from a family which is positive and encouraging, the first 10 or 12 years of our lives are forming that self-image, that self-esteem. So chances are that we'll be happy people out there in the world and everything will be okay. If you grow up with a lot of negativity, that is stored in that subconscious mind. Now, the basic process, what happens is when we are chatting normally as we are now, this is what we call beta rhythm of brainwave activity, 13 plus cycles a second. Hypnosis is taking somebody back down into alpha rhythm, which is the rhythm of relaxation, of meditation, of feeling good. The sort of rhythm that if you're watching a TV at night and you're a bit bored and you're suddenly getting a little bit sort of drowsy, and that's alpha rhythm. It's the rhythm of basic relaxation. Beneath that, delta and theta are sleep. And so it's the halfway state between being wide awake and being asleep. You're in that state very often. Sometimes when you drive, if you drive from A to B, occasionally you can get there and think, oh, I can't remember driving here today. What you've done is you've drifted in. You've handed back to that subconscious mind where all the workings are. So the basic process is to quieten down the conscious thinking mind and talk to the old programs. You can take somebody back if necessary, regress them to an earlier age where the problem actually began. Often that isn't necessary, but it can be done. So you're dealing with a subconscious mind pattern to actually allow them to change that pattern. It's like reprogramming, basically. One of the, for example, a couple of the most common things are stopping smoking, losing weight. Yeah. Now, that goes right back to babyhood. When a baby is fed, the mouth makes it feel good. It's being fed. If it isn't being fed, it may have a dummy. If all else fails, the jolly old thumb. But the baby learns very early on that when it's having something in the mouth, it feels good. Oral gratification. Now, that stays in the computer. Remember, it's a non-thinking process. It's in there as a program behaviour. So if later on when they want to stop smoking, lose weight, whatever, if in hypnosis we can take them back to that basic program, not necessarily take them back to the time when it began, but letting them know that the program that's controlling them is that comfort eating pattern. And then, of course, prior to that, the first part of the session is getting all their reasons for wanting to smoke or stop smoking. It's got to be their reasons. Otherwise, obviously, if I'm telling them when they're relaxed to do a certain thing that isn't their perspective, their choice, it won't be as easy to absorb in subconsciously.
Yeah.
Okay.
So sorry, just to jump in a little bit there. So it's really important. The sort of that the individual's motivation, that has to be strong and established.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. I always think the main things are desire, belief, and expectation. So as they want something, and after all, if they're paying to come here, they want it. The belief is, if they don't have it already, because some people come in and say, oh, very sceptical about this, well, I explain the process to them, how perfectly natural it is, how they will enjoy it. And once you can build up that expectation as well, desire, belief, expectation, then it's a matter of using that process of feeding their information back to them, their reasons particularly important for wanting to do the things that they're wanting to do. And so what you're doing is reprogramming at that other level. The conscious mind has an ability to accept or reject suggestion. So if I said to you, for example, it's freezing cold in this room at the moment, you wouldn't feed that back through because your mind would just dismiss it.
Yeah.
When you're relaxed, you can quieten down that ability of mind to accept or reject to a degree. If anything was said that the person disagreed with, or it was against their moral concept, whatever, that their conscious mind would pop back in. So there's always that overriding,
almost like overriding a safety awareness. Valve, kind of
safety
thing
valve.
That would kick in.
But of course, what you're doing is getting their information, their reasons. You're getting everything that's positive, and everything you're pumping is totally positive into that subconscious mind.
So it's a
heightened awareness. It's almost, you're not asleep. You are aware of everything. If you want to get up and walk out of the room in the middle of it, you are aware. Yeah. If, and most cases we do, they have a CD to use at home afterwards. Once they get used to using that CD, very, very quickly, as they play the CD lossy at night, usually they'll drift quite into natural sleep anyway. The subconscious mind never stops working. And so when they're asleep, the suggestions, which they know what they will be because they're on CD anyway, MP3, whatever, when they're sleeping, those suggestions are going directly into the subconscious mind. They're doing a lot of research now, I believe, into teaching children languages while they sleep, just by playing foreign language and stuff.
The way that kids learn is something that I'm fascinated by, but maybe that's probably a conversation for another day at the moment. So just coming back to your computer analogy then, so is it fair to say, I think most of us sort of on our computer hard drives have got, you know, old Word files or old photographs that, you know, we've been collecting for the last 10, 15 years or however long. You haven't looked at them for, you know, maybe 10 years or something. And that's a similar sort of thing. They're kind of still there. And is it...
It is similar, but what you're talking about is programs of behavior, which of course are a bit more powerful rather than, you know, your old photos and stuff. And I say the first 10 or 12 years are so, so important in the upbringing of a child. I mean, I used to occasionally sit in the lounge here and obviously a guy walked by. There was a playgroup at the end of the road for a while, and this guy would walk by and he had a beautiful little girl, 3-4 years old. She was always walking 5-7 paces behind him. And often she'd be, I could hear her saying, Daddy, Daddy, look, she's seen a bird. Totally ignored. Now that is, to that child, that's abuse, you know. He wants all the attention in the world and just nothing at all. And if he continues like that at home and all the time, that little kid, one time, he's going to think, well, nobody listens to me, you know, and get that very negative feeling, that negative emotion in that subconscious mind, and it stays. It really does stay.
Do you work with kids?
Is
there a sort
from,
of age limit?
Yeah, 6 years old almost.
Okay, well, that's younger
than
I was
their
expecting.
Imagination is brilliant. 6 years old, you can paint a picture. I normally find out what they enjoy doing, or their favourite TV program, or something that they can really relate to. Sit them in the chair and then just do a little story and just tell them they're feeling a bit sleepy, a bit drowsy, but they're having this wonderful dream, or they're playing their favourite football game, which they just finished, and they're now relaxed, or they've been dancing, swimming, you know. So I paint a little picture just to get them into a nice, relaxed frame of mind, and then the positive affirmations to whatever it is they, you know, have come for. Under six, I think they've got no ability really to settle down or relax or take suggestion really. So that's the beginning point. And it's powerful, you know that.
Yeah, no,
wonderful imaginations, brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so just... You mentioned just now about the different brain waves. So I think you said, you know, the sort of beta is our normal state, and then the alpha is that kind of halfway.
Yeah.
And you briefly mentioned there's a sort of similarity with meditation in there as well. So is that something, is that an area that you've got any knowledge and experience
in? Yeah, I use meditation quite a lot. And I do, again, there is a meditation CD. I've got a hypno meditation one, which combines almost the two things, although they do overlap, they are very, very similar. I think with hypnosis, you're using it a bit more specifically for a specific reason, where meditation can be a lot more general, just in quietening down, in changing behavior, and letting go of stress in a similar way.
And what's also coming through quite clearly here, and you know, again, just sort of, we're in your office and I'm looking over your shoulder at your bookshelf, and you've got, you know, Freud on the bookshelf and things like that. Is there a line that runs, you know, sort of from hypnotherapy into more sort of traditional forms of kind of psychotherapy and things like that? Where does the line
I think
come there?
Hypnotherapy is a lot more quickly effective. People can go for counselling or psychotherapy for years and years and years. I had an example. One of my boys in the States, when I went out there, said, "Oh, could I see this particular guy?" I can't remember what the problem was now, but it was fairly severe. But he'd been having, I'm not sure whether it was psychotherapy or whatever, but once a week for about 3 years. I did a session with him. Oh, it was a phobia. And used some NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and the phobia's gone. And I mean, his therapist must have been really, really unhappy, because I think in America, firstly, they quite like to talk about my therapist, so it's a done thing sometimes to keep.
It's much more widely accepted in the States than it is here, isn't it? I think we're still a little bit nervous about talking about our brains.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that hypnotherapy can, in some cases, be a lot quicker, a lot more effective. There are lines which, if somebody is schizophrenic or has psychiatric treatment, I would refer them straight back. I probably wouldn't see them anyway.
Right.
So there's a limit. There's a line to which I know that hypnosis is not the thing to use.
Okay. And is that something that you can ascertain very quickly just from a conversation, or do
usually,
you need to do a couple of sessions?
Usually,
or?
Because of whether they are on particular medication. Part of the intake is always very brief medical details. Everything's totally confidential, obviously. But what they've had medically, what they've had, if they've seen psychiatrists, whatever. If there's any element of doubt there, I just say to them, well, I'd like you to refer back to your specialist. Say you've considered hypnotherapy. Tell them my name, because I'm fairly well known now. And if they want to contact me with any details, not about the particular person, but about what I do, okay it with them first. If something is a semi-medical problem, and I get a lot of things which are like eczema, asthma, psoriasis, a lot of things can be nervously based, stress based.
So you can help with things like that as well, rather than, you know, it's easy for me to see how, like, if you want to give up smoking, for instance, yes, there's a physical element to the addiction and things, but you can sort of see how that would be, you know, your brain, you know, your willpower could really get involved in that. But with something that I would think of as being, you know, a physical thing like asthma or eczema, but that's something that hypnotherapy can help with.
Well, I think that probably 60%, 70% of illness of disease, as I said earlier, is psychosomatic, is of the mind. And I've got to be clear. We can't talk about cures. I never say I can cure you. We don't do that. But if it's stress related, which so many things are, if you can actually take away the stress part, if you can actually get them to be a lot more able to deal with, have a different perspective on what's happening around you in their life or whatever, the mind can have amazing physical effects to the body. And so frequently it can work.
So it sounds like we're sort of, because this is something that I feel quite strongly about. I've got a passing interest in meditation and kind of Eastern medicines and the history of that sort of thing as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I really like about that is that, you know, in China, they have, I believe they have this system whereby you pay your doctor when you are healthy.
Right. That's right.
And when you're ill,
you
stop paying your doctor. Wonderful, which I quite like.
Yeah.
But coming back to what we were saying with sort of asthma and eczema and things like that. So would it be, if I'm understanding this correctly, we'd be looking at dealing more with the initial causes of that problem, and that perhaps the asthma and eczema is a symptom
exactly,
of what's going on, rather than whereas a sort of Western approach might be to simply approach, you know, dealing with the problems on the skin if it's an eczema situation.
And the doctors, bless them, now they're so limited time-wise. I mean, they're 5-7 minutes, whatever, per person. They can't get into the person. They can't get into seeing what's happening for that person in their lives, in their general well-being. So I think the one thing about privately is that you do have an hour, 3/4 an hour to an hour, and a lot of that stuff does come out where you can see is really relative to what is happening in their lives.
Mm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And you touched on NLP as well. So is that a separate thing from hypnotherapy?
Not really. It's basically hypnotherapy techniques, which Grindler and Bandler have expanded into another science, if you like to call it that. I've done a bit of training with Bandler, one of the two people that instigated this. They're very good techniques. I just use some of the little bits, some of the techniques that I've studied with them.
Okay. And again, we might be going a little bit off topic and this, you know, we might be heading away from things. But before we started recording, I mentioned to you that my interest in this kind of stuff is that it's relatively recent, really, in the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And when you talk about NLP and we move into those territories and you start talking about kind of personal development coaches, you know, people like, you know, Tony Robbins would be a really kind of famous example and stuff. Where do you stand on that kind of thing?
Well, I think somebody like Robbins is very charismatic. He can build a great energy, a great power within people. And again, you know, desire, belief, expectation, if you go along and you get whipped up into this wonderful, wonderful feeling of, yes, I can do it, I can cure it, I can be... and it often will work, great. I mean, the man has wonderful success. I think it's personality, it's using basic techniques of getting people to encourage their own mind to bring about change, to bring about well-being. And obviously, he's the king. He does it wonderfully, you know.
That's great. We touched a moment ago on how it took a little while for GPs to be comfortable referring patients back to you. How do you maybe see that moving forward? Do you see a wider acceptance of things like hypnotherapy and NLP amongst the general population?
Yeah, definitely so. It is so much more widely accepted now. I've been asked before to work at one of the medical centres. I know they have an acupuncturist there, reflexologist occasionally. And I just think it would save the National Health probably millions in drugs, because the number of prescriptions now, drugs are actually horrendous, aren't they?
Yeah. And coming back, you touched on this, and, you know, I mean, thankfully, touch wood, I haven't had to go to my doctor too often in recent times. But the last couple of times I have, it's as you say, you know, it's very definitely, you know, they're under so much stress. They've got to get through X number of patients per hour, and, you know, they don't have the time to really dig in.
I mean, that's the biggest problem. They have time.
Yeah.
But I'll be the first, if especially if I broke a leg or did something that I felt was medical, I'd be like a shot. Of course I would. And I would never say to anybody, don't go to your doctor, please. That's got to be your first call, always.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, moving forwards, you know, in your area, do you teach? Do you train other therapists at all?
I don't do that. I used to teach self-hypnosis at Technical College for a number of years. It was a 6 or a 12-week course. But now I just fill my time with so many other things that I put a day aside. I walk into this room on a Wednesday. The outside world doesn't exist. I do 2 or 3 minutes of what I would call meditation, but just putting myself into the spot where I am here. And nothing else matters during that time, the people that I see. But the rest of the time, I've got children, grandchildren. I get involved in carnivals. I do a lot of judging. I do a lot of marshalling. I do so many other things, which I so enjoy that, you know, now I don't want to, I don't do home visits. I don't do any teaching outside.
Okay. And just picking up on that, you said when you start your day, you do a little 2 or 3 minutes. Would you, it'd be great if we could pass on like a practical tip to people. Would you be comfortable sharing, you know, what you do in those 2 or 3 minutes?
Just basically, I think it's mainly a sort of breathing technique, which is the basis of so many things like meditation, relaxation. It's getting settled down into a point where you're thinking about how your body and mind are at that particular time, telling yourself that your body and mind are working towards perfect health and harmony, and then just looking at your breathing, slowing your breathing right down, because that's the first signs of stress or panic attacks is normally the breathing. Slowing down your breathing and then having one or two positive affirmations, things that you want to bring about to change. One of the most important things also is when you're doing that is not to use a negative, because the subconscious mind doesn't understand negatives. And so to say something like, I will not be afraid, what the subconscious mind holds is the word afraid, because it's very emotive. So instead of that, I will stay calm, I am in control. If it's a breathing problem, my breathing is perfectly natural, and I am allowing myself to be more and more relaxed. You can often use a keyword, which for certain other practices would be like a mantra, but I use the word relax. So I tell them to use the word relax 3 times in their mind and be aware that their breathing is slowing down. And be aware if there is any particular stress in any part of their body. Some people it's their throat, some people it's the stomach, shoulders getting very... And there's a nice little NLP technique where if you can imagine that stress to have a colour and a shape, whether it's a headache and they respond brilliantly normally, and then you imagine that colour getting lighter and lighter and lighter and the shape smaller and smaller, and then you imagine that just floating away from whatever part of the body it exists in. Now, the quickest way through to the autonomic nervous system is imagination. And if you can actually build an imaginative picture and then make it totally positive and just allow that particular thing to flow away, and it can be quite amazingly powerful how you can do that.
Yeah. And I guess that links back to what we were talking about with the kids, right? Is those young kids have got the imagination. Yeah. So that's the sort of thing that they can really... Yeah, okay. Would you have any, you know... I mean, I was going to say general advice. That's probably a little bit... leaving things a little bit broad. But what would you say is something that you commonly see that you just wish you could, I don't know, stick on a billboard on the high street or something and just say to people, look, just don't do that.
I just think that most things are probably about perception.
Right.
And if you have something that stresses you, situation, a person or whatever, and I mean, we normally say something, oh, that person really stresses me out, doesn't it? They don't. You stress yourself out. So if you can actually take the attitude of what is my reaction, why is that reaction, and change your way of thinking. Now, if you are stressed out by a circumstance, first point, change the circumstance.
Right.
Get the person out of your life, change the situation if you hate your job, but if you can change the stressful situation, change it. If you can't, and of course you can't always, then you've got to look at your perception, the reasons for it stressing you, ways in which you can deal with that stress and perhaps deal with the situation more lovingly or in a, with a different way of looking at things, a different perception. So, yeah, if it's stress, change it. If you can't, look at your perception and the reason that it's having that effect on you. Because everything, it's all feelings. Mm-hmm. And basically, although it's very easy to say they are feelings and they're very powerful feelings, but of course feelings can be changed. You can actually take yourself out of that situation for a while and use certain methods just to allow that to be less powerful, less invasive in your life.
And that leads on, and you know, this is something that in the past I think I know I've struggled with, and I'm sure there's lots of other people who have as well, which is, you know, the sort of self-talk that goes in on in our heads is, you know, I was reading a thing recently where, you know, someone, I can't remember who it was, but they were making the point that, you know, the way you talk to yourself in your head, you
absolutely
wouldn't dream of talking to anyone else in that kind of way. And I guess, you know, these things are all connected, I think.
And you've got to realise you are your own best friend. I mean, you know, you're the best person that you've got. And if you can be kind to yourself. And what technique I use quite often, it's a Louise Hay. I've done all her training. She was a wonderful lady. A technique where somebody's self-esteem is very poor or they can't really, they don't like themselves. And it's mirror stuff. You get them to go home, sit in front of the mirror, look in the mirror and just say, I love you. And you look at yourself in the mirror, look in your eyes, hey, I love you. I'm a lovely person. I love and like myself. And some people just can't do it. They say, no, I can't. And when, okay, I said, well, come on, we'll do it now. I want you to just say, I love myself. And the embarrassment and the laughter and all the stuff that comes up, it's that old programming, you know, that goes back somewhere to childhood where they haven't learned to love themselves, you know. Really basic stuff, but it quite can make a difference. And it can be very, very powerful, very powerful. Yeah. And it's a bit, I hope it haven't made it sound too simplistic. I hope somebody's listening and thinking, oh, it's very, very well for him. He's got a good life and he's not, you know, it's everybody is an individual. So I sit with them if they are here and try and relate what I'm doing to them, to that individual person.
So just heading off on a little bit of a tangent. Now, we talked a little bit about how you got into this, you know, when you were young and the influence of your mum. Who else, outside of your parents, who else is someone who's had a really big influence on your life?
I think mainly on training, on therapy trainings. I mean, Gil Boyne, who was one of the leading American guys, wonderful. I think he lived his practice. He believed what he preached and lived it. Very, very, quite charismatic, but very honest, very, very open, very loving person. And there were one or two others that worked with him that I just found were great, great leaders, and who obviously believed in what they were doing. It wasn't a selling feature. They actually lived and loved and believed what they're doing, you know. And they're so, so very, very important. And it's quite funny talking about influences of childhood. I mean, my parents, wonderful, loving, beautiful people, but so very introverted, so very quiet. And I remember always as a kid, mum always saying to me, shh, the neighbour's quiet, you can't have your music loud, you can't. And that had such an influence. And I was almost teenage before I could realise I could actually put my records on loud and enjoy myself. And
What did something change? What was it that enabled you to
kind of
break that?
I just one day, because of doing therapy and realising that you can change patterns, I thought, that's a pattern. I'm shy, I'm inhibited, I won't do things in front of people. I've got a really deep shyness, and I thought, well, that's got to go. It's just, and it, I mean, it's still there. It still comes in occasionally, now if I jump in my car with the top down, put some music on, and go as loud as I like, and I think, way, here I am, great.
So in a sense, your first client was yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's still working on myself, so.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think we're all doing that, hopefully, right?
Yeah.
So if someone was interested in, you know, we touched on, you know, the sort of psychotherapy and obviously your hypnotherapy and NLP yeah. and all that kind of stuff. It's a world that I personally find utterly fascinating. Mm. And for someone like me who's interested but doesn't know that much about it, what sort of resources might you suggest would be a good place to start? Is there a particular book that you could recommend, or, you know, website, or, you know, where might we find, where would be a good place for us to start?
Depending on their interest, certainly there are some very, very good books. Psycho-Cybernetics is a really good one. Horrible title, but it's brilliantly, it's so good. Any of Louise Hay's stuff is good. So I would refer them book-wise. I would tell them about, say, the National Council of Hypnotherapy, which are one of the leading ones that you have to be in practice so long, you've got a code of practice, et cetera, et cetera, with a lot of information. So I would give them information of places to look, internet, books, certainly. And, of course, you can get CDs, MP3s, you can get on the line now, and you can get anything on anything, really. I do a very limited number of CDs, but go on the internet and there's thousands of them, and they're mostly good stuff. Yeah.
Okay. And so, just moving away from that side of your life at the moment, is there something you could maybe share with us that might surprise people to find out about you? Obviously, I think those of us on the island who know you, you know, from therapy and from the toy shop and all those kind of things. Is there another little secret?
Only really that I'm still shy. I still, if I got to go out somewhere, Elaine's wonderful. She's extrovert. She loves partying. If I've got to go to a social thing, I don't really want to do that. I'm quite a little hermit, really. But I do what I have to do, and I'm happy with my choices, so I'm not sitting here thinking, oh my god, I can't do this, can't do that. So yeah, I'm really, you know, sort of got that inhibited part of my nature, without a doubt.
Mm. And, you know, as you say, you sound happy, you know, you seem to have a lot of things sorted out.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you still have those moments, those days where things aren't quite working out quite how you
we all get days like that, but I won't say lucky, because I've worked very, very hard all my life. Even as a kid, I used to go and sell apples and do paper rounds and do, you know, I've always worked. I love work. I think work is a wonderful ethic, and so I've built what I have. But what I have now is a wonderful family, beautiful children, grandchildren, lovely home, holidays when I want them, nice car. I've got everything, really, and also am sort of satisfied with what I have, which I think is a nice place to be. If I won a million or two tomorrow, I wouldn't change my life. It would, really, you know, apart from shelling quite a lot out and giving a lot away and doing some good things. I'd love to do that.
Yeah. You know, is there a particular cause that
well, I did for years. I paid into this thing called Plan, and it was helping a family in the Sudan, and they were getting water onto this particular site, and they sent photographs of the particular person that you would adopt. Yeah. But it there was some publicity, and I read that the actual one of the leading guys on the committee of that particular one was on $125,000 a year, mm-hmm. and it did make me really think. And of course, with a lot of the other ones, that they're earning such massive salaries, that I thought, well, I can do a bit more locally, and I actually stopped doing that.
Okay, so your focus is more local,
yeah.
Then okay, which
and I do a lot for the community wherever I can. I love getting involved. I said to you before about carnivals, driving, judging, all the other stuff, and I love the Isle of Wight, and I put back, you know, what I can.
And that brings us back round. Obviously, you came to the island when you were sort of 18 or so, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And you've been here a little while now. What, just to finish up, what would you say is the biggest change that you've seen on the island in your time here?
That's difficult. I think the biggest change is in the way the island is as a tourist environment. And whilst I don't want to be negative about it, but when I had my toy shop, for example, I would open in the season 10, 11 at night, often have a job to close June, July and August. The street would be packed with people. When eventually I got closed, I'd walk home. There was a pub called the Madeira that was always busy with entertainment, with families packed. On the opposite side of the road was the Clarendon, another one, packed all the time. I just think the volume of people just don't seem to be here. And it's a shame because it's a beautiful place. It's got so much to offer. But I think it all needs sort of upgrading, uplifting and putting on a different level somehow. I don't know.
Okay, so I mean, let's talk slight magic wand time here. So, you know, you do win, you know, you win the Euro Millions or something ridiculous, and you get that opportunity to wave a magic wand over the island. What area do you think you'd focus on first?
Oh, what a difficult question! Wow, I've never given that any thought. I really don't know. I'd probably build some more sheltered entertainment areas, like, not exactly like Disney because you don't want to over commercialize, but giving the people so much more to do, make sure all the beaches were really A1 standard, develop the seafront Shankton, lovely, you know, it's pretty good. Sandown now is beginning to be developed, which is good. So I think generally to smarten up the island, and hopefully continue it to be a nice holiday place, which we can enjoy so much in the winter when we get it to ourselves and it's lovely and quiet. Difficult question, that one.
Yeah, no, interesting time. Den, I'll wrap things up there. That's amazing. Thank you so much for being so candid and talking so openly. We really appreciate that. And for everyone listening, I'll put all the details of the things that we've talked about, links and stuff will go in the show notes. So it just remains for me to say, Den Clare, thank you ever so much for your time
this morning. Thank you for being so kind.
There we go. That was my conversation with Den Clare. I hope you guys enjoyed it. As I mentioned, if you want more details of any of the things we talked about, you can find those at my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston. And if you did enjoy it, please do also tell someone else about the podcast that we've got going on here. Hopefully you know at least one other person on the island or further afield who might be interested to find out a little bit more about some of the people that live down here and what they get up to. So you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, you know, all the usual places that people get their podcasts. So do please spread the word, everybody. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.